In every generation, there is a virgin. He alone will watch the vampires, the demons, and the forces of darkness for the first time at least once a week. I am a Buffy virgin.
Welcome to another season of Buffy Virgin. I'm Michael. I'm still a Buffy virgin, even though I've seen an entire season of Buffy. Season two is brand new to me. Today on the show, we have John Landis, a school teacher.
Hey, everybody.
Dennis St. John, a horror cartoonist.
Hey, we finally made it through season one. I'm so happy.
And for the first time, I'm revealing Dr. Travis Frog as Dr. Travis Morrison McKell.
Hi, good morning, good evening, good day.
Welcome to real life, Travis.
Yeah.
I'm going to miss the frog.
Travis, do you want to talk about why you didn't want to use your name in season one?
Oh, it was, season one was just that bad, guys. No. No reason at all, actually, but the frog thing became kind of annoying. Well, I was cursed by a frog, had a frog sold, and this, you know, a lot of things just have happened in the past couple of months, and I'm back, I'm human. It's great.
Okay. Congratulations.
Thanks. Thank God the curse is lifted.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't realize there was a curse, so good to know that that's been taken care of. Glad you looked into it.
I had a techno pagan, you know, so it was pretty simple once I got a techno pagan involved. So
you're off the lily pad and back to your own pad.
So this episode, we're starting a lot of different new things structurally. So we're going to start by playing a radio drama summary of season two, episode one, as told by John Landis. After that, we're going to get into talking about this episode of Buffy, which is season two, episode one, When She Was Bad. We're going to discuss our weird noticing, some trivia, some questions, themes, predictions. There'll be a kill count and then some recommendations. So a little bit more structure than we're used to, but we had some time to think about it in the interim between the two seasons. So we'll keep you stuck the whole season, or maybe things will change. I don't know. So let's start. We're going to play a pre-recorded summary of season two, episode one.
Season two, episode one, When She Was Bad. It's been a long summer. Buffy has been out of town visiting her dad, and there isn't a lot to do in Sunnydale. Xander and Willow walk through the graveyard, quizzing each other on movie quotes, trying to pass the time. Xander decides to reenact the ice cream scene from Witness, but with Willow in the Harrison Ford role. He leans in to lick the ice cream from Willow's nose. It's pretty funny at first, but then things start to feel a little romantic. Xander leans in slowly, cue the piano music, and they're attacked by a vampire. Xander does his best to fight it off, but it's not going well. Just when we start to worry about the two of them, a blonde-haired hero in a miniskirt arrives and saves the day. It's Buffy, and she's back. Back at Buffy's house, her divorced parents share a rare moment together. Buffy's dad says her time with him over the summer was just fine. But it was just fine. She didn't seem angry or sullen. She just seemed distant. Back at Sunnydale High, though, we discover that all of our favorite characters have returned for season two. Cordelia is still self-centered, Giles is still stuffy, Miss Callender is still super hip, and Principal Snyder still hates kids. After a somewhat cold greeting, Buffy and Giles resume their training regimen. But something is off. Instead of a triumphant training montage, Buffy is having flashbacks to her fatal last fight with the Master. She goes a little overboard, kicking her sparring dummy into tiny wooden splinters. Giles seems worried. Cut to a darkened warehouse. There's a sort of vampire preacher who addresses his vampire flock and tries to vampire-inspire them to put their faith in the Anointed One as their sort of vampire Jesus. Buffy and the gang are hanging out at school when Giles arrives. He's concerned about some new vampire activity. All in all, though, it's a pretty normal day at Sunnydale High. But what's this? Giles is strangling Buffy while Willow and Xander look on, pretty nonchalantly. Buffy pulls the rubber mask from Giles' face to reveal the Master. And then she wakes up in her own bed. It was all a dream. Good thing there's nothing creepy going on in real life. Oh, it's Angel, sitting in her window. He's here to warn her about some new vampire activity. Buffy is unusually short with him. He says that he misses her, but then he leaves before Buffy has a chance to reply. Back to the vampires. Vampire Jesus and his vampire preacher dig up the bastard's vampire bones. The consecrated ground burns their vampire hands, but Vampire Jesus just urges them to vampire try harder. At the Bronze, Willow and Xander are taking in a Chibo Motto show as they wonder aloud about Buffy's weird, new, distant, cold behavior. Willow wants to pick up the romantic ice cream moment they had earlier, but Xander's not interested now that Buffy is back in town. Speaking of Buffy, she's arrived at the Bronze. Angel's here too, and he wants to know why Buffy is being so icy towards him. Buffy pretty much walks right past him and proceeds to do a sexy dance on Xander. Angel finds the sexy dance upsetting. Willow finds it upsetting. Even Xander is freaked out. Having upset everyone, Buffy leaves abruptly, only to be confronted by Cordelia in the alleyway. Cordelia is not trying to be Buffy's friend, but Buffy needs to stop trying so hard to be a B-word. That, after all, is Cordy's department. Buffy storms off, just in time for Cordelia to be kidnapped by vampires, and they already have Miss Callender. On her way home, Buffy swings by the Master's grave, but his body's missing. This is not a good sign. She confronts Giles. He hasn't heard of a revivification ritual being successful, but he has heard of them. Buffy is pretty pissed that he hasn't mentioned this before. Giles says that in order to revivify the Master, the vampire cult would need the blood of the person closest to the Master when he died. Obviously, that means Buffy, since there's nothing more intimate than killing one another. Suddenly, someone throws a vampire note through the window with Cordelia's bracelet. They want Buffy to go to the Bronze. It's clearly a vampire trap, but Buffy will go anyway. On her own. Because she's sick of trying to fight evil and protect civvies like Willow and Xander at the same time. So she storms off. After she's gone, Giles discovers that he was using a poor translation earlier. They don't need the blood of the person closest to the Master, but the nearest person. Physically, literally nearest. That means the note was a trap. For all of them. By the time Buffy figures all of this out and makes her way back to the library, the vampires have already kidnapped everyone except Xander. It turns out they don't need him for the ritual, and Xander lets Buffy know how angry he is with her for trying to handle the situation alone and getting everybody else attacked by vampires. Buffy tracks down the vampire cult by doing some enhanced vampire interrogation on a vampire lady and finds her nearest and dearest, and Cordelia, unconscious, hung upside down from chains. She kills several of the vampires while Xander and Angel wake everyone up and help them escape. See, teamwork pays off. Once the danger is past, Buffy confronts the Master's bones. Trembling with emotions, she smashes them to a powder with a sledgehammer. Back at school, Buffy is worried that she's alienated her friends with her behavior and has put everyone in danger. Giles tries to put her mind at ease, and when she sits down with them, everyone is still friends. Roll credits.
That was fantastic.
That was great. That was great, John.
Just so amazing.
I don't know what the difference is when you record your own voice beforehand, but it's just so much smoother than...
Well, I had to do a lot of takes to pronounce revivification right, and I'm still not sure I quite got it right.
You nailed it, man. I mean, I've been listening to you for the better part of 20 years, and it's... I should have been listening to recordings of you for the past 10 years. I'm just kidding, man.
Yeah, I definitely have recordings of John Landis. That was great.
I'll remember that.
I'm totally done with live John. I just want pre-recorded John.
Can you read me my email? You know what? I'll skip back on track. I'm sorry.
All right, so now we're on to the random noticings and stuff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Jenny Callender goes to Burning Man, which I just wanted, like, you know, back in 97, I think that was like, maybe like a less known thing. Like they had to describe what Burning Man is and stuff.
Well, it definitely means she's cool. Right.
So here's the thing about that being cool is like my boss, Jeannie Schultz, who's like almost 80, goes to Burning Man every year. Maybe I shouldn't have used her full name, but she's Charles Schultz's widow. Goes to Burning Man every year.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that's what I think of as Burning Man now.
But I feel like I don't really know. I've never been there. I don't know what it's like. But I feel like if there was a character in a TV show now, like in a sitcom now, if somebody went to Burning Man, it would mean that they're kind of douchey. I feel like is how what that joke would be.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Like any indication of that from his calendar? I think it's just that she's really cool. Like she's really hip.
Yeah, and it balances her out versus Giles. But
right. I don't think Giles goes to Burning Man.
Yeah, I could picture modern day Giles going to Burning Man. Yeah.
Even though Burning Man is sort of douchey, it's still really cool. So I agree. Like culturally, it's less meaningful. It's still rad. Like I definitely talked to people from Portland who have gone to Burning Man and told me how amazing it is, who have talked shit about it, but then still want to go. So
yeah, I'm sure it's actually great. I don't mean anything about the actual festival. I mean, every time you see stuff from it, it does seem cool, but it does seem like we've all culturally sort of decided that a Burning Man person is a certain kind of person.
Is there like a cool festival like now that has like the cachet that Burning Man once had? Coachella's played out too, right?
Yeah, I think Coachella's pretty played out. My brother has gone to Coachella a couple of times, and he's fucking crazy.
I think if there was one that was actually cool, I wouldn't know about it.
All this is that became like popular, right? I mean, Burning Man was, you know, this was before you could read about Burning Man on the internet. You could see.
But if it's on a show, then clearly, like, somebody had to know about it.
Yeah, there were Hollywood writers. I mean, we all know they're commies and they're sadists. And, you know.
There's a Burning Man episode of Malcolm in the Middle, so that tells you how cool it is.
There's a Burning Man episode of The Simpsons really also.
I don't know. I mean, Coachella, don't like a million people go to Coachella a year? Like, it's a giant festival. It's got to be played out because 200,000 people show up or whatever, right? How many people go to Coachella?
I don't know.
It's huge, right? It's like they destroy a whole valley, right? They
definitely destroy a whole community to make it
happen. Yeah, they already destroyed 99,000 per day attendance for 6 days. 600,000 people.
So we don't know what the hip thing is now, and we shouldn't know because
it's email.
If we knew about it, it wouldn't be cool anymore. I don't think we're the
Gmail is the cool thing for 20.
No, imagine if in the show. Remember how crappy email and stuff was in Buffy season one. I know I don't want to bring up Buffy season one because I think we all have PTSD from Buffy season one.
No, so it's a good transition to the PTSD in this episode.
Yeah.
Which I think is fairly accurately done, fairly well done.
The PTSD.
That Buffy suffers from. They're like, I mean, not that I'm not diagnosed with PTSD, but my therapist said I had some symptoms of it. And that kind of the like flashing, the like just the random image flashing of it, it seems fairly accurate to me.
So another thing you're noticing I need to talk about from this episode is Chiba Motto. This is kind of the one. Because in high school, I didn't watch this show. And I recall when Chiba Motto became a thing that everybody was very excited about, particularly you, Travis. You were like, Poli, Michael, you got to listen to Chiba Motto. And I was like, what? Who, you know, because we had, I think mostly we're on the same wavelength about a lot of musical things. Or I was on wavelength with somebody. But Chiba Motto is like, I was totally clueless about where this interest came from.
And I think so.
You just discovered it, like, oh, this is what everybody's been, yeah. I think, important part of Buffy Virgin is, like, you finding out what everybody in high school was talking about.
Yeah, trying to tell you in so many words.
Well, it was, like, eye-opening. I felt like I'd solved a mystery in my life when I saw this episode. Because I like to subscribe to Details Magazine. I felt, like, up on cultural stuff, but, you know, they never discussed what happened in an episode of Buffy on Details, really.
And this episode really heavily features Chiba Motto, like way more than you'd think.
Yeah, they play like two different songs.
And they all get close-ups and like, yeah.
It's crazy. I'm sorry, Mike, there's still more Bronze stuff. I mean, I'm stupid. The Bronze was like 6 minutes of this freaking episode. It was really long. If you listen to like the audio version of this episode, like, there's like 6 solid minutes where nothing happens. It actually feels like in a freaking eternity, actually. But there's like 6 minutes where it feels like nothing happens in this episode, and they're just dancing.
Yeah. Well, yeah, if you're listening to the audio, then the dance would be totally meaningless unless you had like, we would add Willow describing it to Angel. Be like, why are they dancing so close?
If Willow had recorded like a plot summary of that dance, it would have helped. I don't know how many callbacks I'm going to try to do, but I'm going to try to do a lot of callbacks.
Angel was really creepy this episode, which you mentioned in your thing. Just I mean, it's a total vampire move to just be watching somebody when you sleep, but they don't play it like it's creepy. Maybe that's why it's extra creepy. They play it like it's romantic.
I mean, Buffy responds like it's creepy. Like, she instantly picks up that it's creepy, but then at the same time when it, like, ends, she's really sad and, like, scared. It's, I don't know. Well, I guess that kind of reinforces things. But.
It felt like after that, if Clarissa explains it all, right? You know, when her page comes over and, like, puts a ladder up to her window because, like, Angel's just hanging.
The Angel's, like, 240.
I would like to lead into
years too much older than her.
Scene. Where Angel confronts Buffy, like when she's on her way to the Bronze, and he's like, "Why are you riding me?"
The famous "Why are you riding me?" scene.
Oh man!
Classic Angel dialogue.
The best part is this is the episode that the bad Angel dialogue dies its horrible death and is staked to death and doesn't rise or anything like that. Like, the "Why are you riding me?" comment is literally the nail in the coffin to the bad Angel.
So wait a second. I'm not sure. Now, we can discuss this in the next episode, but what you're saying, to be clear, Travis, is that from now on, Angel dialogue is good.
Yes.
And that Angel acting is good?
And Angel acting is good. It's like someone did like a, yeah, I was going to say a spell or a curse on him, but it's like all of a sudden, like, his bad acting curse is lifted after this episode.
I will say that when he yells, "Why are you riding me?" that's the most emotion he's ever put into a line, because before that it's just the
worst line. It doesn't play in any form of English. Most of that's the English you learned when he, you know, fictionally was alive. It's just a terrible line.
Well, not to mention he's stalking her.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the reason it's weird. It's because it's like, she, how do you, like, follow somebody around, show up at their, like, window, and then follow them around and then say, "Why are you riding me?"
That's typical, classic aggressive male behavior.
Classic.
I wanted to bring up Buffy's really, like, her Slayer skills have really gone downhill, because she turns her back and walks, like, 10, 15 feet away from Cordelia, and she's grabbed by a bunch of vampires, and she doesn't notice. Like, that had to have made some noise. That's just bad Slayer skills right there.
Why are you riding her?
I'm just saying. Sharpen up. But she does, in the first vampire she kills in this episode, she stakes with a tree, which I enjoy just because it's a little bit of one of her unusual Slayer slangs.
I looked it up, and it does appear that the first vampire was a jump scare. Like, I think I looked it up, that's what it's called, a jump scare. Like, where,
yeah, because the way he pops up.
The way he pops up, yeah. So, I don't know, that's kind of fun. But I don't know if that's either played out or maybe, like, they're trying to revive it. I mean, this is 1997, so it got played out in the 80s, but are they, you know, the jump scare is really huge now.
I think the jump scare is eternal. I mean, people try different ways of doing jump scares, but it's, if you're making, like, a horror movie, you're always going to try to have some jump scares.
Or it'll be, what is it, Midnight at Freddy's, and it's all jump scares?
Whatever. Yeah. Five Nights at Freddy's.
Yeah, Five Nights. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think some random things that I noticed. Number one was that the lighting was really good in this episode. So I feel like they either hired someone who can do lighting.
Yeah, they're just the dramatic difference between season two and season one. Like, lighting is better. Like, the sound cues are better. I think Buffy looks more like Buffy now. Her hair is, like, simpler, not like these complicated buns that used to go into or whatever.
She really grew up in that year, or in the 9 months after they filmed this episode. Like, the face, she really just got older. It was one of those crazy times when you're a kid, and 9 months makes a whole lot of difference. I also like to say that Cordelia had a cold most of the episode, but her voice is pretty normal at the end of the episode.
Oh man, at the end, I want to talk about Cordelia and Jenny walking together, and they don't look like a student and a teacher. They look like peers. Like, this whole illusion of, like, some of these people are in high school and some are teachers, but they're all basically the same age. Like,
right, because we can't cast anybody in high school who's younger than, you know, 25, or we can't cast anybody who's older than 30, so...
Yeah, they should really just keep those characters not in the same seat, like... Just like, it's so dramatic when it's just those two, and they're like, "All right, are they sisters or are they?" Other random thing that everybody gets attacked while in the library, and like the library is their Hall of Justice or whatever, but it's the worst, it's actually the worst place to have that, since like vampires know where they are, vampires can get in because it's a public building, like
right. So vampires can't get into anywhere that's your house. So anywhere mm-hmm. where a person lives is magically safe from vampires. So why would they meet anywhere else?
They need a proper headquarters. I'll predict this, they're going to get a proper headquarters at some point, and it won't be the library.
All right.
Other prediction. Oh, I guess this is later. I'll wait.
This is later.
Yeah.
So we talked about this, we watched this, but when the vampires are digging up the master, why didn't they bring more shovels?
Yeah. I think that it's supposed to be like, oh, the vampires are like so savage that they're digging through ground that's been consecrated and it's burning their hands, and it's supposed to be like dramatic and intense, but it's really like these cheap fucking vampires can't afford shovels. Like, it makes them like such a less threatening cult to be like, they budgeted 3 shovels.
It seems just insanely painful too, right? I mean, it's kind of cool to know that like they can go through the pain. And of course, we see Buster kind of like push through pain as well, demonstrating to the anointed. But like, it's still silly.
It's a lot more dramatic.
And the I also want to talk about the master's grave, because it's clearly in a real regular cemetery that looks like it's well maintained. So the groundskeeper just allowed this. Like, then there's just a patch of dirt that looks like a grave and has like 4 like wooden crosses around it. But it's not on any of our plans on our big cemetery map.
Right, and no one's looking for it. You know, they don't have a lot. Like,
really. Well, why bury him in a cemetery? Why did they decide to consecrate the earth and bury him in a cemetery? Why not do that anywhere else?
Yeah, come on, Giles.
Sometimes cemeteries are adjacent to churches. We don't know that. I think the bigger question that you're not asking is, and this is the only one where this is true for the whole series, why, when this vampire was killed, did he have bones and he didn't go to dust? I mean, that's kind of the...
Yeah, we aren't talking about that.
Yeah, we're not talking about that. I don't know why, but we're not.
We could. Because that... Well, that leads into my recommendations for later, but...
Okay. All right, well, I guess we'll hold off on that then.
Well, no, we can talk about it. I think it's just supposed to indicate... Well, this would have been a season 1, episode 12 question, really, because we see his bones there. But I think it's just supposed to indicate just how powerful and old a vampire he is, that like parts of him remain.
Yeah. No, that's totally what it's supposed to do. And you know, and I can't tell if...
So wait, being a vampire is like the opposite of being a Jedi. If you're like really powerful and you die, you do have a body.
I would say this happens a lot in... you guys seen Blade before? I watched Blade recently.
Have we ever seen Blade?
In Blade, when you know Wesley Snipes' character is fighting vampires, most of them just disintegrate instantly, but the boss vampires don't. You know,
yeah, so that one dude who looks like the dude, he keeps getting like burned to pieces and pieces of him cut off, and he doesn't die.
Right.
It's the it's the same thing with like Angel goes through anything that would kill a regular vampire. Like Angel just goes through and is like, oh, that hurt.
I guess. All right, let's.
I don't think that's breaking the timeline too much to say that like the hero vampire gets hurt more.
Yeah. You know, what I can't tell is, was this done? I'm trying to figure out the motivation for why he has the skeleton. I mean, for the master. I mean, was this solely done for this one episode? Because this doesn't really come up again. I mean, I guess because it'd be great if they played into that mythology some more in the series, because then I think it would be more interesting. To me, this is kind of like a one-off, like, hey, I know what we're going to do for season 2, episode 1. You know, I guess it all kind of makes sense, right? Because there's no... I guess this must happen to other vampires, because Giles talks about revivification. It is really hard to say. Revivification, or, you know, it's, you know...
Can we just say resurrection?
Resurrection, yeah. Those damn British. Sorry, John.
Oh, I have a new game for this season, which doesn't come up much in season 1, but spot the stunt double, really obvious in this episode and throughout the rest of the series. So that's my new drinking game, is spot the stunt double.
Well, don't play that, you'll be in a hospital.
Doesn't work in season 1 because you can't see anything.
Yeah.
That's why.
They also don't have a lot of dramatic fight scenes, you know.
Well, okay, let me finish this thought.
No, I'm going to interrupt again.
Please. Oh my God. So I guess to me, it'd be a little more interesting if they readdress this. You know, they kind of say this resurrection sort of spell working, but I mean, that could be for demons as well as vampires. I don't know. It was an interesting, it's an interesting concept. I mean, it's an interesting way to get through an episode where you can deal with your PTSD. And so, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's really interesting. It's not done again. Although I've got to say, this series, of course, is obsessed with death and resurrection. I mean, yeah. So I guess you wouldn't really recognize that going, I mean, it's sort of like looking backwards to forwards, but anyway, so I think this is a cool episode for that. Anyways, I thought the other things I thought were notable was Buffy and Cordelia in the alleyway was really cool because Cordelia like becomes a real character and offers like real advice. So that was certainly much better writing for Cordelia.
Right. Yeah. I think twice this episode, Cordelia gets called a bitch or is being like, people treat her mean when she doesn't do anything. Like,
yeah, like the Three Musketeers comment.
Yeah. And they're like, well, that was a bad insult. And it didn't appear that she was necessarily insulting them, right?
Buffy was doing most of the insulting this mm-hmm. episode. Yeah, but of course, Cordelia has this great line that I think we all called out, spank your inner Moppet.
Yeah.
Like telling Buffy to get over it. And, does anybody know what that means?
Well, I think we kind of figured it out that like Moppet is like a colloquial term for like child. So it's like your inner child.
Yeah.
So it's just a play on like express your inner child or like some, there's gotta be some expression similar to that of like release your inner child or something, but it's like just a joke on that. But it doesn't work because it's too much Buffy speak. This is like also season two, like we're finally getting into like, the like what you think of as Buffy speak, the like weird dialogue playing and stuff, and this was just like they added too much weird joke to like one line and it made it like,
yeah, it's a lot of layers to be like, okay, first of all, inner child, but instead of like whatever it is where you're supposed to be kind to your inner child, we're going to spank our inner child, so that's a layer, and then a layer on top of that is that instead of child we're going to say like the weirdest possible word for child.
Yeah,
it's like, yeah, the joke doesn't quite work except that it totally works because it's just really weird.
Yeah, because it throws us all off. We're like, what is, I need to go into deep research mode to find out what Cordelia is saying.
That whole weird interaction is weird too. She's like, you know, watch your Joan Collins tude. Like, it's just a weird series of strange things that no young person would say.
Yeah, the Joan Collins is a weird reference.
Joan Collins did a lot of horror movies in her later years, so. Xander gets dumber this episode for sake of humor.
He's like, so dumb.
I mean, it's funny. The thing of like he can't spell bitch, so he's like Bitka.
Yeah.
And then the like we're gonna eat her or whatever, and then they're like they're gonna cook her a meal.
Yeah.
Like, just for the sake of comedy, he becomes a dumber person, which is great. That's we should always sacrifice character development for humor.
This is like the one episode where horny Xander doesn't make an appearance and yet he has the sexy dance.
The sexy dance, yeah.
I mean, are we going to talk about the sexy dance? I mean, I feel like there's a pretty serious conversation to have about the sexy dance.
Sure, why not?
I just like, because like, here's my question. So like, I think I know what the answer is, but I want to ask you guys like, what is Buffy's actual motivation for that? Like, why does she do that? She does it right after, like, Angel kind of confronts her, and she does it in front of Angel. Like, why is she doing that?
This is something only... I mean, it's hard to relate to Buffy and to doing this, because deliberately alienating people is an insane thing to do. But, yeah, she's trying to alienate everyone so that she, you know, because it's her responsibility to be the Slayer, and they shouldn't be involved with it.
Right.
She's acting out. She's angry. She doesn't want to be who she is. She wants to destroy her. She just wants to alienate people so that her life isn't real. So her real life sucks.
Yeah.
So
I think she's trying to feel less.
So we can all agree that there's no little even hint that she's in any way attracted to Xander, right?
Oh, zero.
Yeah. And like, I guess like my read on it is that like, you know, Xander's been super not subtle about this crush that he has on Buffy, right?
Yeah, well, obviously, even in Buffy's dreams, she recognizes that because he's like, "We're your bosom friends, friends of your bosom." Which is a line that happens in her dream. So that's her platonic idea of her friend is like hitting on her, right?
So she like, yeah. So like, even though they don't say things aloud, everybody, like everybody involved understands everybody's relationship. Like they all know that Willow has a crush on Xander. Xander has a crush on Buffy. Buffy and Angel are almost an item, but it hasn't really happened yet. And so she knows all this and she's been walking around with this sort of all this, you know, I guess power to manipulate these people for a year. And when she realized, I guess she sort of gets to a point where she realized she doesn't actually have control over anything else in her life. Right. And so it's just like, I don't know. That's how I tried to make sense of it.
Yeah. Well, I think she comes into town at the end of the summer, not exactly feeling like they're like these people who were her friends last year are necessarily her friends again. And I said while we were watching, I don't know if I actually think this or not, but I said while we were watching and you asked that question that by objectifying herself, she's treating herself like less of a human and therefore having to feel less. I don't know if that's actually how I think, but it popped in my head.
I think she came back and had like a pretty good attitude. And then all of a sudden she had to kill a vampire and she hadn't had to kill a vampire in 3 months or 2 months or whatever summer break is right now. But, and so it's like, I think she just was dealing with that this entire episode. I don't know. I'm not sure it was like, I think her acting out was just her acting out at the sexy dance.
I think
like just manipulating people for the hell of it. Because she's just pissed off that her life still kind of sucks. I don't know. That's my read on it.
I feel like we've all seen, you know, this kind of thing happen though, where people emotionally manipulate like that. So it's not an unfamiliar thing. It's just disappointing. Like in real life, occasionally, and you know, I've seen this happen with, you know, girls I was dating or whatever, where, you know, they want to punish you. And so they, in real life, they have sex with other people, that they don't care about in order to, you know, to show their power or to like tell you to back off or whatever the case. Like there's a lot of weird, powerful messages in that. Like in a more adult show, she probably would have made out with Xander or had sex with him, you know, and Angel may have looked through a window and seen it. Right. Cause it would have been, her, if she knows how to get to.
I'm glad we didn't have that scene. That would have been so uncomfortable. I like the line, lust and thrift, about fighting our inner demons, like lust and thrift.
Yeah, that is a good line.
Just to totally disrupt this conversation.
So to talk a little bit about some other stuff that we brought up, apparently in the like trivia part, you know, torture works here. So there was this amazing cross-boarding scene that John...
cross-boarding or water cross. Both sound like sports or are sports. I don't know.
Where Buffy puts a cross down a vampire's like mouth and then shuts it. This is kind of, I mean, we, you know, it apparently works. They get the location of the gang.
Yeah, I don't think it's particularly important in the episode, but like, I guess there is sort of like a moral question there of like, if a vampire is, even if you like can see that a vampire is pure evil, is that give you the does that make it morally okay to inflict suffering on them?
Well, I think it is important in the episode just because it shows where Buffy is and how destructive she is at this point. Like, because normally Buffy wouldn't do that, right? Like, she has no problem with staking a vampire, but she wouldn't, like, there's lines, right? So it's more of a statement about where she is at the time. And that it works is weird. Like, the alternate version would be the vampire gives wrong information, they go there, nobody's there, and then all of her friends are dead, and the master's back.
Yeah.
So, and then that's a way darker season, too, where lonely Buffy, with only the help of Angel, like, has to fight the master.
That would have been a really interesting
season. I'm thinking about some fan fiction right now.
That's AU. That is...
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to talk about in the weird noticings trivia?
I There's a lot of scenes in this episode that make it into the new opening credits. So those are good for drinks.
Yep. So the
I think I'm the only one playing this drinking game by myself. Yep,
just you. The vampire preacher on the Buffy wiki, he is noted as Absalom, I assume because that's how he's in the credits, but he has no name as far as I can tell anywhere in the dialogue. Is that, do you guys pick up a name for him?
I didn't. I did want to, another thing I forgot to write down is like, he gets caught on fire. So like the scene where he gets caught on fire, he has to be covered in like grease or something for protection. So I think that's why he's so oily for the like rest of the episode, to not make it noticeable. But that's a really good death. I like that fire death.
Have we established that the vampires in the Buffyverse are killed by fire up to this point?
I don't know.
I think that's just assumed. We just like, oh yeah, it must be fireworks too.
But they really, I mean, this is like, welcome to season two, right? And like, they've pumped up like their action. Like, she does that thing where she stabs one and sits the other in fire at the same time. They've like actually hired a fight choreographer for the first time instead of like just right. people who are doing their best, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just so noticeably different.
Yeah, it's more interesting.
So yeah, thank God.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a good fight scene at the end. It's kind of fun. Well, compared to what's come before.
Yeah, yeah. Not compared to like what we see on TV now, or you know, a movie or something. But,
right? But it's or YouTube. I'm just kidding.
So if there's nothing, no other kind of weird noticings, so let's go on to these questions. John, you have a bunch of questions here. Do you want to start out?
Yeah, I'm just going to go to this one. I love the scene, and it's not very long, between Buffy's parents. It's just like, it just completely got to me, because there's, and we've talked about this in past episodes, that, you know, growing up with divorced parents or having divorced parents, one of the things that is really freaky is when your divorced parents talk to each other. And, you know, because like, and Buffy's parents are clearly, they get along pretty well. They're able to be in a room together, and they're able to talk to one another. And the only thing they really have in common is Buffy. And so they talk about Buffy. And Buffy's dad kind of owns up to doing the divorced dad overcompensation thing, where he's buying her unnecessary things. He's helping, you know, he's paying for these shopping trips. And I just wanted to ask you guys, if you're, so for Mike and Travis, whose parents are divorced, like if your parents did the overcompensation thing, I think mine did, but not so much buying me things. I think they did things to, my mom especially would do things that, you know, to make me want to hang out with her, that she, you know, things that she knew that I would like, or things that she knew I would think were cool, which is, I think at the time felt manipulative, but looking back on it is just my mom being nice and loving.
John, you have to clarify there who you live with most of the time, because that's the cruise.
Oh yeah, like, so yeah, so I live with my dad. Yeah, that's a good point. So I was living with my dad.
So your dad didn't have to do anything special.
That's true. He didn't have to do anything special. And so
he's
mom,
a good guy. He's a good guy. I'm
just, yeah. Yeah, your dad's a great guy.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely.
I always liked coming over to your house, and your dad was always a nice guy. So.
Yeah, he's a super nice guy. He still is a nice guy.
We're friends on Facebook. He posts great photos.
Yeah, but I guess I wanted to ask you guys what your experience was with the overcompensating divorce.
Can we do a shout out to Dan Landis?
I'm not friends with him on Facebook. Sounds like
Dan, you let us use your Mac, your Apple computer all the time to play SimCinema, and for that we are grateful. And please, those of you out there, Google SimCinema and play it.
Yeah, it's worth sending up an emulator for an old Mac to play.
Yeah, I'm sure we're too loud all the time in your basement, so I appreciate your dad just letting us be whatever it is we were.
Be super weird in the basement.
Yeah.
My dad, I live with my mom, I'm not sure my dad would overcompensate, just because he traveled so much, and then eventually he moved to a different state. So, I don't necessarily think I have that same experience, because he wasn't like competing with my mom for me, because he lives so far away. Right. I think that was probably the crux of the matter.
my parents didn't really talk after getting divorced. Like, neither of them really wanted to communicate. So there was never a Joyce and Hank scene where, you know, they're talking about how, you know, how Michael spent the summer or whatever the case. But I think I definitely overcompensated from my dad's perspective, like, or maybe he just did the things he always wanted to do, but I never did any traveling with my mom. And it's interesting, right? Because like I've done a lot of really exciting world traveling with my dad, you know, going to Thailand, China, Turkey, etc., ton of cruises, stuff that my mom would never have spent money on. So, this has come to pass, you know, in real life where my mom doesn't do any traveling now, even, but my dad continues to travel. So I don't know if it was overcompensating, but it felt like a little bit of that. And then he'd do randomly, I don't know, my dad gives random nice gifts, but they're just things that he wants. So it's not really, doesn't really feel like super overcompensating. It sounds like, here's something that's worth a lot of money and it's precious to me, Michael, here. Yeah, I'm not really, don't really want another rug, but thank you.
I was going to bring up the tangential trip to Turkey.
Yeah. As
being very important.
Yes, in the this next question. But I guess for me, this scene never happens in real life. So the
conversation... In the ideal world, it does.
This should happen.
Yes.
This should be a, like, responsible conversation between two adults about what to do with their kids. In reality, I think parents don't want to... Once they've divorced, it's like they broke up. They don't want to talk anymore. And then they have these kids to deal with. And maybe occasionally there's a phone call or an odd, stiff conversation. But it's pretty minimal. It's more like two countries that don't communicate trying to negotiate a treaty, but without any emissaries or like out any responsible diplomats to do it for them. So it's just like, it's very, I don't know, very, very ancient, like some ancient, more ancient civilizations.
Well, I always knew it was like super, whenever my parents were talking to each other about me, it wasn't as casual as this. It happened because, you know, my parents are both pretty good people. It happened, but it was when something was really like, I was doing something really fucked up, you know, like I was like, oh, John's dropped out of school and he has a bad job and he's, you know, sleeping 12 hours a day. Maybe we should talk to him about that.
I won't bring this up. I'll bring this up later. There's one incident where you got in trouble in high school and I was involved in it. I want to know if your parents talked about that.
I don't think they did, actually. I don't think that warranted. Also, that was earlier.
That was reassuring.
That was closer in time to the divorce. So I think there was probably like a cooling off period after the divorce where they never talked to each other unless they were like signing papers, you know?
Yeah.
Or maybe there were fights probably that I wasn't around for. But
Yeah. I mean, it's like insane. Like the Hank and Joyce, first off, I'm thrilled. I'm so thrilled that there's a Joyce scene. There's two Joyce scenes in this episode, actually. So we didn't talk about Buffy in the car with Joyce, which is amazing. Just I could watch an hour and a half of that scene. Just Buffy in the car driving with her mom talking. That's great. But then also, of course, the Joyce Hank scene. And it's like it's great. It's also a little bit weird because in this scene, Joyce is like, I'll be lucky if Buffy gets through the school year.
Yeah, actually, that line of dialogue has always kind of haunted me a little.
It's so negative. Like, she doesn't believe in her daughter because all these bad things have happened.
Yeah. It's such a classic, like, the parents don't see anything of what, like, that's not her daughter's experience at all, right?
Yeah.
Like,
it's such a frustrating line. And it works, but if you think about it for longer than 2 seconds, you hate that line.
Yeah. Well, it's like, I wasn't there for it, but I know, like, my mom got so paranoid about me failing out of college and then dying in the Iraq war. Cause that's like where her mind goes, right? Where it's like, well, then you'll get drafted. And then and it's like, never mind the fact that there's not a draft.
Oh yeah. She said that to me. She said that to me. It was like, this is probably around like 2005 or something. And she was like,
yeah.
I hope Dennis passes Swahili so he doesn't have to go to Iraq. And I remember that sentence saying just sounding so crazy.
But it's like, that's how my mom was, where it was like being very nice, but like extrapolating these crazy things where you're just like, you know, it's like, if you don't like the chocolate she likes, then like you can't live in the house anymore or something, you know?
I just assume that's how parents are, but I'm not a parent.
Maybe we should just quit and do a podcast about our parents.
Oh God.
Swahili?
It's looking like it might be time.
Hold on, did you pass Swahili? I guess is my big question.
Oh, no, I stopped going to class and didn't tell her. I was not a good student. But that's a bigger question that I don't want to talk about in this podcast about how I was as a college student.
Well, I'm about to bring up a trip to Turkey that Mike took that changed the course of history.
Can we just go to the next question?
Do you want to talk about this one about have you ever felt alienated from a friend after a summer vacation? Is that
Well, it's not that I felt alienated. It's just that there's this infamous trip that Mike took to Turkey with his dad and his sister for like 3 weeks, summer of eighth grade. And then when he got back, of course, I had to stay there with his other unnamed friend, you know, as our worlds collapsed around us, right? This other friend, of course, became a drug addict in like 3 weeks of Mike being gone. And then he comes back and it wasn't alienated, but I just always I always give Mike crap about this, but it's a great
story. I'm sure people tuning into this podcast because they want to hear people talk about Buffy the Vampire Slayer are like super into this conversation.
The question. Alienated from a friend after summer vacation, right? Because Buffy is incredibly alienating to her friends. And I did not intend to alienate anyone. I felt similar to you, Travis, coming back from 3 weeks in Turkey. I think it was 2 weeks, by the way. through Istanbul and, Anatolia. Had a great time. Crazy, crazy time. With my dad was going with a woman I thought he was going to marry at the time. But, you know, it didn't happen for whatever reason. And coming back, and you had worked on some lawn crew with a couple of people over the
summer. That was my first job.
Right. So you had your first job stuff. But you guys were really tight and making all these inside jokes. And I felt like Buffy does when, you know, Willow and Xander are cracking jokes about stuff that happened in the past. I felt kind of alienated. I'm like, I missed out. And that's how summer vacation feels. Like, you do something or anything, like people have moved on and have tons of inside jokes. Like, we already have inside jokes from doing this podcast, which, like, I know my wife doesn't get because she doesn't listen to this podcast. But I've like maybe tried to crack. I'm like, no, you're just doing some good prop work.
Oh, I'm a little bit sad that Elizabeth doesn't listen to her podcast, but. Yeah. Nothing I could do about that.
She doesn't like podcasts, period. She doesn't listen to podcasts. So.
All right. Well, I think the Buffy Virgin Twitter follows her, so. I'll start aggressively messaging her.
She just doesn't listen to podcasts. They're too highly unstructured for her. She likes things that are more organized. This wandery podcast that is now discussing what happened in eighth grade is
a little bit awkward. Well, I mean, I know. It's awkward. It's strange. It's weird. I'll get us back on track.
That's what I want to talk about, though. I want to talk about what happened in eighth grade and ninth grade and what happened to Dennis in college. But anyway,
I don't want to talk about what happened to me in college. Answer the question, I don't know if I ever felt super alienated after a summer break, but like I moved a lot and, I always felt alienated when I went to a new school all the time. I had a really hard transition from moving from Oakwood to Bloomington, which you guys were all a part of, like, not the hardness of it, but like you were there for that. I probably made life a little difficult for you guys, being so like not letting shit go. I don't know.
What? You were so far away. Although thank God you weren't actually that far away.
Yeah. I mean, it's not everybody, like the thing I did of like obsessively, like driving back to Dayton every weekend I could, like, not every high schooler does that. Right. They move on and stuff. But I have like,
we love you.
But I have like haunted memories where I'm like, you know how you like something pops up into your head and you're just like, oh, why did that come up? I have things of like sending Mike an angry email because he didn't come visit me one time. And I was like, that was so uncalled for. Like this, you know, shit like that. I have to say, I watched the presidential inauguration which was really rough. But there was a point where they're talking about Obama, and they're like, and it's unusual for a president to stay in D.C. afterwards, but they're going to stay in D.C. for 2 years so that their youngest daughter can finish high school. And I, like, started crying, and I was like, what a good dad. My like,
oh.
Because obviously, like, the exact opposite thing happened to me, but
yeah.
It's a tough time. It's a tough time to move, man. All right.
Yeah, I agree. Like, staying in the same place is super important for a kid's sense of place, for like their friends or their community. I feel terrible for kids that move a lot. I've moved a lot as an adult, and like, yeah, I don't like it. I don't like this moving stuff. But yeah, like Travis, you've moved a lot. I've moved a lot. John, yeah. We've all moved. None of us live in our hometown. Like
in my adulthood, I've moved a lot. Yeah.
And but it, I think actually we also share another similarity between Michael, John, myself, although we all moved from our primary schools to a different high school. Although Michael moved first from his primary school, John later, and myself around the same time as John.
Yeah, because John and I went to the same primary school for a brief period of time.
Yeah, 2 years, maybe.
2 years, and then I went to Catholic school. But yeah, anyway, yeah.
Which is weird, because I went to a different Catholic school. I don't know what our parents were thinking. I was trying to grill my dad about this. We're way off topic, but I was trying to grill my dad about this. Like, what were you thinking going from Montessori to Catholic school? Like, why did you go from one extreme to the other?
Gosh, we need to do a separate podcast about this, John, because I've been writing a bunch about that lately, about the Catholic school experience, because it's so alien to the rest of my life.
Yeah.
I'd like to join. I only did Catholic school for a year, but I was raised Catholic, which actually my dad and I totally disagree about, because he doesn't think I was raised Catholic.
You don't need to go to church to get the guilt culture.
But I did go to... I was forced to go to church constantly. Remember in high school, I had to... like on Saturday night, I couldn't spend the night because I would have to like leave at 3 or 4 in the morning so I could be home for church. Like,
I don't remember that. Oh, that's right. You guys did know. You guys went to like kind of a groovy Catholic church.
It was the UD church. I mean... Yeah.
I remember that now.
Yeah, I had to go to church up until college, and Ma still kind of expected me to show up to church every Sunday, but I didn't. But like,
wow, that's cool. Why so much church? Why? Who's? It was important to your mom.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. Dad doesn't think we were raised very religiously because he kind of knew Mom, obviously before us, and didn't think of her as a religious person. But it's like I knew a very religious person.
I didn't go to Catholic school. I went to like a private school and then to, so I missed the whole Catholic situation.
Yeah. I went to private, to Catholic school for 1 year. And then I went to public school in New Orleans for like 6 years. So like total dramatic shift. Yeah, we could totally do it. God, this is nothing to do with Buffy, guys.
Let's talk about it. This is super important. This is more important than Buffy. So this Catholic school stuff is really interesting. So I went for 2 years. My parents had raised me Unitarian beforehand, and I continued to go to Unitarian church while going to Catholic school. But Catholic school is full of so much indoctrination and brainwashing. Like your art class, you draw Jesus and the apostles and scenes from the Bible. You go to church on Friday, every Friday morning. And your teachers tell you crazy stories about miracles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I continued to go to CCD. I was an altar boy in New Orleans for a number of years. I got crazy fucking stories about that. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this or not, but you know, I got attacked by my priest one time.
Yeah, you did tell me this, only briefly.
I mean, fucking Catholics, man. That would be a good horror story.
Well,
there's a lot of good Catholic horror.
The story I keep telling from my Catholic school experience was not as horrific as that. I wasn't attacked, but my teacher just told a lie about a miracle. And it like, and this is not cool to do to kids. Like, I mean, that's a really impressionable age and you believe all this dumb shit. And she said that she took a silver necklace to the Vatican and it became golden. And like,
really?
That is crazy.
That's crazy. That's legit crazy.
Yeah. I'm like, fucking alchemy. What the fuck?
Some old person tells you that you're like, oh, I guess that's true. That must be how the world works.
I mean, I think some teachers in Catholic schools are probably pretty good. And I think even some of the ones I had were pretty good, but you do got to wonder about teachers who work in Catholic schools because they get paid a lot less.
Mm.
And you got to wonder why people take that job. I don't know anybody who does it now, but you look at what they pay. It's really low.
But that wasn't a religious teacher. That was like an English teacher. And then, of course,
yeah.
teacher.
Well,
so I'm just saying, like, there's all these different weird worlds that teachers preside over. And in the guise of Catholic school, in a public school, you would never say a crazy story like that. But in a Catholic school, well, that was probably not, canonical stuff to say. Like, that was okay. And there may have been another teacher in the room, like, nodding along to that story.
Yeah. In fairness, though, do you remember, Mike, at the Montessori school we went to? do you remember Mrs. Meeks?
Yeah.
Do you remember her telling us that there were backwards satanic messages in rock and roll music and that we shouldn't listen to rock and roll music?
Oh, I guess I didn't think that was real.
So I'm just saying you can go to a crazy lefty, you know, you can go to the where all the crunchy professory parents send their kids to spank their inner Moppets or whatever. you still get your dose of crazy.
That's true. All right, so I went off the rails. Okay, let's get back in here.
Oh my God.
Private school, there wasn't anything that said that was crazy. Everyone is just really rich, and if you're not, you're just a loser. So
that's how I felt going to Oakwood for 2 years.
Yeah.
So well, yeah, I guess Oakwood felt the same way, huh?
So moving on here to another school-related thing, which will probably bring up more stuff, but... there's this conversation that happens between Giles and the principal, Snyder, where they're going back and forth about, well, Snyder's presenting his version of what he's seen. Essentially, high school students are like locusts, right? They're these aggressive sexual insects that are just trying to get on top of each other. Giles is ignoring him because he's looking at, you know, calendar, right? But like that kind of perception of children as being these weird sexual creatures, like that... and then how school kind of contains that when it's probably its most dangerous. And I know that, you know, Buffy is a lot about sexuality. At least several episodes in season one have been. I don't know if season two will be. But there's a little bit about that already. But it feels like, what do you think about, you know, this administrator's perspective about sexuality? Do you think that, because that's got to be such a strange thing as an adult, as a principal, presiding over a school where you're witnessing all this really budding sexuality. I mean, I'm sure no one's as candid. It's not, maybe because some people are more candid than Snyder. I don't know. I mean, it's basically people like us, I assume, that preside over these schools, right? You know, I can't be too different. But like, what do you think about that? I can ask more specific pointed question because I kind of have an idea of that. But
I mean, the oldest kids I teach are 11 and 12, so they're sort of like at the beginning-ish of puberty. And it is uncomfortable to watch that happening to them. And I have often just sort of wondered, like, it seems like the worst possible thing to concentrate that. Like, it seems like take everybody who's going through that and put them all in a room together. It seems like the worst thing you could do. but I don't know if I have a point of view that's anything like Principal Snyder's.
No, I don't know what the official point of view of us on any of this. I think we're pretty agnostic as far as points of view about sexuality, but like you're basically creating this insane dating environment with these insect-like creatures that want to date. And then they're all contained in this reality show environment, you know, that, you know, in one building, and then forced to pretend like they're not sexual creatures for most of the time. And then like, when they're on and they're off time, you know, they act out. And it's just like, I don't know. I guess that sense, sort of like teeming sense of sexuality, like I feel like you'd see that constantly as an administrator. And I know they talk about this in the prison systems, right? That they, you know, give prisoners chemicals, like some kind of chemical castration in some cases, so the people don't act out some of their impulses. But like, why don't we do that in schools? I don't know. I totally.
Wow, Mike.
You're like worse than Principal Snyder, man. You're like an evil genius.
No, but I saw him, like, why don't they do that? Because Giles is like even caught up in it, and there's another teacher, you know? Like,
I mean, Mike, bottom line, life will find a way. I don't know. I'm not. Thank God I don't have to deal with this specific scenario. I think the solution is, of course, you know, smaller schools, more villages, more fresh air.
And good sex ed, right? We need good sex ed.
Yeah. Protection. Yeah. Solar power, wind power.
high school sexuality is such a nightmare for me. And like that whole time period, you know, college is at least a little bit more organized, but like, it's just a nightmare, and the administration doesn't help, and it has no, it's agnostic opinion of nothing happening. And maybe like, look at them. They're like locusts, like, cool. Everybody probably thinks that administration, that like, wow, look at all this crazy stuff going on and these weird hookups and whatnot. But like, the fact that there's no appropriate education about relationships and what it's like to relate to others is terrible. I think that to me spoke to me. Anyway.
I mean, I identify with Giles in like blowing that guy off because of, you know, his point that like, why do you work here if you hate children? Because you meet people like that when you work at a school who are like constantly like really upset about the, I mean, you know, we all get upset sometimes, but there's people who are always like they really don't like kids and they made it their job.
Well, there's people who don't like the government who are in the government. So
yeah, that too.
John, did you write these other questions down?
I'm not sure what you're referring to. Oh, we talked about Buffy's motivations already.
Yeah. So the how do you give advice to a friend question, is that you?
Oh, I don't remember if I wrote that or not.
Oh, yeah. No, I wrote that. I'm sorry. Okay. I didn't know I was supposed to annotate it.
Maybe initial it so people don't just read it off. Maybe we'll do it next time. Anyway.
I got it. I'm all over it. I guess this came up because you know, this is in reference to Buffy kind of going all dark and being angry and isolating, and you know, Willow, Xander, Giles, everyone, and Angel, you know, surprisingly, it's all like, you know, what's going on? So I think it's just a pretty like age old question. Like, how do you reach, how do you get through to someone who's clearly on, oh wait, there's a good Buffy line, who's clearly on a self-destructive path? Yeah.
That's a tough question, because I feel like Buffy deals with that in season one as well, right? Like,
And Angel deals with this in several seasons.
Right, no, but like Xander going down the wrong path when it's like he's after he wants to be with the Mantis lady.
Yeah.
You know, like, everyone's clearly telling him it's a mistake.
when Willow wanted to date that robot demon.
Yeah, everybody knew that was a mistake, yep.
Well, I mean, it's like nobody in the episode, though, gives Buffy a ton of leeway. It gives Buffy much leeway, which I think is really weird. And the episode itself seems like it's of the opinion that Buffy just needs to get over it. And like, she's been through a major thing, and she's going through some feelings. Like, it's weird that everybody to a person in the entire episode is like, oh, what's her problem? When it's really obvious what her problem is.
I think Giles is fairly understanding, right? He at the very beginning is like, if you need more time, and he explains to them that she's not possessed, that she's dealing with issues.
No, but he's such a British twat. Sorry, John. So he recognizes the problem, but he doesn't do anything about it. He just says, if you do need some time. But in reality, he needs to say, I'm sorry, you died. What's going on, man? I mean, that you don't need to say, you need some time to work something out. You know, that's such a lame-o. That's not constructive. And I guess
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. Everybody needs to be nicer to Buffy in this episode.
No, they just need to be honest. Yeah. I sound a little bit like Dusty right now. They just need to be honest and just say, hey, it's clear that, you know. So anyways, I don't know. I that's why I find Buffy not necessarily blameless, but totally understandable, because you know, in a lot of other like episodes, it will be like the other characters will present like two different views, like when, you guys are gonna hate me. I'm gonna bring up the episode "Never Kill a Boy on the First Date."
Owen.
When Buffy's late to the date with Owen, Xander's like, she's like, I couldn't go there. I was late. You know, I couldn't tell him I was like slaying demons. And then you know, Xander's like, you could say. He had some line where he could just say, you know, late watching TV. I forget what he said.
Flat tire.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, John. But no one does that for Buffy. It's like in this episode. So it's not like they gave her a ton of great advice, to be quite honest.
Well, and also though, usually in the show, if somebody is having issues, it is a metaphysical reason. Like, you know, they think she's possessed, right? Yeah. But like in the pack, when they think.
Usually it is possession.
Yeah, Xander's possessed. So it is reasonable in this world to assume, like, if somebody's being weird and not themselves, then maybe she's got, like, yeah.
But the reality is, right, like, in real world, you can't give anybody advice when they're going down the wrong path. No one ever takes
right.
it. Yeah.
People, well, listen.
I don't know.
I think you just are yourself. You're the best version of yourself you can be. People tune into the parts that they are interested in, or that they, if you say something that means something to them, it will mean something to them. And you don't get, there's no like advice moment where it's like, hey, I noticed that you're hitting the booze a little hard. You know, like you don't really get to give advice like that. If anything, that alienates people and they're going to find another way to do the thing they want to do and just without you. But I don't know.
I feel like there are people who genuinely want advice, but they're just very rare. I don't know. I mean, you're right. Most people don't want advice, but I think even fewer people ask for advice.
Like, I gave my dad a meaningful gift this holiday, a book about, it's called The Art of Tidying Up. It's a book that I read, I love, about how to keep a clean house. It's by a Japanese woman. And my dad's a little bit of a hoarder, and I was like, hey, I think this might help you out. It's a really good, it gives you a system for organization if you don't have one. And he said, I'm not going to read this.
Did you tell him I'm giving you this book because you're a hoarder?
He knows what that means. I mean, yeah, totally.
Yeah, you told him that in so many words?
Well, he said, I am a hoarder when I told him what it was about. And he said he wasn't going to change.
Yeah.
But there's an example. I'm trying to give this guy some advice. I'm like, maybe I can do this.
Oh, you can try. They don't. People really accept your advice.
Like sending me articles about why I should be consuming more bee pollen or something, you know? And like, it doesn't connect with me at all.
Yeah, I agree. But I think that's kind of why I want everybody to be nicer to Buffy. I don't think anybody, including Cordelia, needs to stop her in the hallway and say, you know, stop being mean to your friends. But what they need to find some way to make it clear that they're going to be her friends no matter what. And I think they don't do that.
Well, they also are high school students.
Yeah.
They also get kidnapped, I guess, halfway through the episode.
I don't mind that Buffy's friends are not good to her. I think I mind that the episode itself seems to send the message that this is Buffy's problem. Like she's the one who's being bad. Like it was called When She Was Bad, right?
Yeah,
I think it's enough to acknowledge that. I think that within the context of the show, the fact that they have this episode, that it's like she doesn't just immediately get over being killed the previous episode, but instead has an episode and presumably a summer and stuff where she's having a hard time processing it. That's the point of the episode. Like,
yeah,
I don't think the show is coming down on her about that because they would if they did have a negative view of that, they wouldn't have this episode to begin with. They'd be bouncing back in normal Buffy fashion.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I guess I would say I agree with you, Dennis. I guess I'd say I wish like they, Buffy is certainly dealt with very well. The friends, like, you know, Willa, Xander, Cordelia, like I don't think though they're written like to support that. I mean, I guess at the end, you know, it's sort of like, it's just like wander under a bridge, which is also like a truism. Like it is true. Like at the end of the episode, I mean, I just wish it was written like more supportive. Like you can be supportive and like acknowledge horrible things happen. And you don't always have to be like, you know, silly water under a bridge or just, you know, nonchalant. I guess I kind of do. Like, I guess we could grind our enemies into dust, but we did that last night. So I guess it's trying to say, yeah, I guess overall the episode does okay again, I guess.
There's one other question here. Does that kind of fit in, which is how do you deal with near-death experiences? How should you deal with it versus how you actually deal with it? Is that yours, Travis?
That's also mine. It's uncredited. It's ghost written. Oh, no, not ghost written. I'm not a ghost yet. That's a separate issue.
Straight from frog to ghost.
Well, I mean, what was my near-death experience? Well, I woke up and I thought I was dead. That wasn't.
Sorry, what was the full question?
How do you deal with near-death experiences, like versus like how you should deal with them? Right?
Oh man, I actually thought about this. You know, in the dream sequence, where Buffy's being killed and all her friends are just kind of ignoring it. Like, that brought a flashback in my head of the time when I was a kid and my brother would do this thing. He actually did it twice, but he would do this thing where he would, when we were in a pool and I was a stronger swimmer than him. So he would swim out to me and then just grab onto me and stop swimming and almost drown me. And I had a really strong memory of like drowning and looking, making eye contact with one of his friend's parents. And they didn't recognize what was happening. Cause I think one of the things I've heard recently is like, you know, drowning doesn't look like what it looks like in, shows. So a lot of people don't recognize when somebody's drowning, but I remember like her just looking at me and then turning her head like, oh, they're playing or something, like having a like disinterested look while I was like struggling to survive. So this the thing of like friends ignoring or people ignoring when you're going through something is pretty accurate. So yeah, I mean,
with our democracy right now, so it's really interesting.
All right, I have two near-death experiences.
I better cut it. No, Dennis, thank you for saying that. It's a crazy story. That's terrifying.
Yeah.
So the first was my stepbrother. I told you this before. My stepbrother hung himself in the kitchen while I was in the kitchen. Okay, obviously this sounds like I'm not very observant, but I was reading... was reading a Spanish language edition of People magazine at the kitchen table. And, you know, I was just reading it. And I was comparing this like weird scratching sound, like something was scratching, like a dog or a rat or something. And we didn't have either of those. So I was just reading my People magazine. And lo and behold, he had hung himself with this belt around his neck into the door. That was sort of popular, I think, in the mid-2000s or early 2000s. I think it was like a thing on a TV show or a...
On the wire,
yeah. And then, of course, he got himself in trouble, right? Yeah, because obviously, I mean, it's a dangerous thing to do. Don't do it, obviously. And, you know, I'd leapt up from the table and, you know, got him unhooked. He did it. He was okay. He was good. Boy, you can really ignore things when you're reading a magazine, I found out.
That seems to be a common thing with both our near-death experiences is like ignoring.
I mean,
I was also, ignored, you ignored.
Also, well, hold on. Also, what are the odds that you sit down and read a magazine? And the household was always very noisy. Okay, there were like 10 people living in that house. It was just the most random thing. So that was also very strange. And then, of course, there was the day I woke up and I thought I was dead. Now, that was freaky.
Wait, are you going to explain that?
It was just...
You don't have to.
The weirdest thing. I mean, you know, just sort of woke up at 4:30 in the morning. And, you know, just woke up and everything was... A lot of lights were on. I couldn't hear anything. And I felt... It was just like... Like you had muted everything. It was a very strange, and it lasted half an hour. And I was like, "Huh, that's just a very strange experience." I really should, you know, after that happens, you're obviously very happy to be alive, but it's so stupid, humanity. We just have these such short memories, and you know, you sort of forget to really treasure every day you're alive. And
that's so true.
And it's really tough, but I mean, if only dying is just like this weird ghost-like state I was in. It's probably worse.
Yeah. So I was in a car accident earlier this last year where the car I was in was hit by a semi truck, and it was really scary. And I was fine. And then I was the only person in the car. I called my wife. She didn't really understand what's going on. I didn't understand how to explain it. But anyway, I had this really brief feeling afterwards of like how amazing it was to be alive. And I remember I went to like the grocery store, the stupid Fred Meyer, and like that weird grocery store moment where you watch other people shop and you're like just really honed in the details of like, wow, that person's really taking a long time to figure out this Apple stuff. And just that stupid kind of thoughts about how whether people are thinking and being able to slow down and see that and not see my own stupid thoughts, but to see other people's thoughts. It was a really brief magical feeling of seeing what other people were thinking. And then it went away.
Wow.
I became an impatient person after a few days.
I do not have any awesome near-death story, guys. I mean, not awesome. That's the wrong word.
Awesome in the religious sense of awe.
Yeah, in the religious sense. Yeah, I don't think anything like that's ever happened to me that I can think of.
I kind of have like recurrent nightmares from this time in high school when I think Mike and I, we were driving on the highway and we were jumping from the driver's seat to the passenger seat.
That happened, yep.
That is so dangerous.
Why would you do that?
We knew it was dangerous. We were laughing about it.
I've driven up a mountain in a blizzard without snow tires, and I was really, like, I lost control of the car, and I was like, why am I doing this? I put my own life in danger only because I didn't want to be in my apartment and, like, go to the studio to draw, and so for this, I, like, almost died.
Like, I was going to guess it was for a girl, but...
No, it was literally because I wanted to draw a comic and didn't want to be in my apartment for another minute. Usually I put snow tires on in the winter in Vermont, but I like hadn't done it yet. And
what comic were you working on?
I think it was probably like the last chapter of Amelia.
Oh, it's totally worth it then. That comic is really good. Everybody go to Amazon.com right now and look up Monsters and Girls Amelia. It's really, really good and buy it.
Thank you. Thank you.
That last chapter gets really weird.
Yeah. I was probably dealing with some near-death experience shit while I was...
The last scene is a snowstorm. It all makes sense now.
So
I'm trying to think if I have any other near-death experiences.
Theme deep stuff in this process. Can we get the predictions now for the next...
Yeah, let's do predictions. Yeah.
So first, before we get into your new predictions, let's talk about predictions that were either confirmed or denied in this episode.
Please.
We didn't do this last episode, so I'm going to do some late ones. So first of all, in episode 2, Mike, you predicted that Cordelia will die in season 1. Season 1 is now over, and Cordelia is clearly not dead. So that one is denied.
I die now? What happens?
But you also predicted in season 1, episode 3, you predicted that Cordelia will continue to be punished, which I think that being hung upside down, unconscious, by some evil vampires counts as punishment. So we could say that one's confirmed.
All right, great.
You predicted on that same episode in season 1, episode 3, that there will be no funerals in season 1. I think we can say that that has been confirmed. Unless I'm missing one, I don't think there were any actual funerals in season 1.
No funerals for life.
And finally, this is our last one. You predicted in season 1, episode 10, that Buffy will, after the Nightmares episode, that she will revisit a dream world in Buffy. And we do have a dream sequence in this episode. We're going to say that counts. So that one is confirmed as well.
Okay, wonderful. So the ones I want to add to this prediction list are, I think I already said earlier, but you wrote it down. Awesome. The gang will get a better headquarters than the library. And I predict that Giles will lose his job at the high school. I know that.
Why?
Hold on. Is this season 2? These are season 2 predictions.
No, I think those are they season 2 or are they overall?
So I don't know when they're going to get a better headquarters. Probably not this season, but they will eventually need to get a better headquarters than this stupid school library. I don't know what it's going to upgrade to, but it's going to be a little bit more remote and maybe have some cool traps.
Okay. I like the trap idea.
Just overall predictions. Okay. All right. Series predictions. Okay.
Giles is going to lose his job.
I want some season predictions from you.
I think we're being really specific with Mike in an almost cruel way.
Be nice. I think the Anointed is going to get killed this season.
Ooh.
So you don't think he's going to be the villain for the entire season, or do you think he's going to die at the end of the season?
This is boring. He's boring. He's going to get killed off or assume his final form, whatever it is.
This isn't even my final form.
So the official prediction is that he will be killed or change form.
Right. He can't be a little boy for another season because he's not going to be a boy anymore. And they're going to have to justify that.
They're going to have to Walt him, right?
Yeah, totally. Walt him into another world. I think Snyder's going to get killed this season. I'm sad about that, but sorry. Goodbye, Snyder.
Snyder will be killed in season 2. Yep. Okay.
I predict that Polydamas predicts that there they will eventually, the gang will go to college.
Okay.
You don't have to make all your predictions now. These are plenty. These are plenty. This
is all. Yeah, you got to do predictions every week, Mike. So hold some.
Pace yourself.
All right, great. Okay, so the next part is Dennis's kill count.
Oh, I actually have a couple different kill counts because we only see five actually get staked, but the tortured vampire presumably dies, so that's six. And Angel fights a vampire. We never see him stake, but he survives, so we can maybe assume that that vampire is dead, so that's seven. But it's all vampires this episode. Buffy kills most of them, all but one. So she's got a really high kill count. No humans die, but many are in danger.
Wow, no humans die in this episode.
Is this the first episode where no humans die?
No, I don't think so. I stopped doing the kill count last season, but I'm trying to start it up again. But we can look it up. But I'm pretty sure there's been an episode where no humans died.
Nightmares? Did anyone die in nightmares?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think no one died in nightmares. But I think there's very few where nobody dies. So this is kind of cool. So it's kind of unusual.
Do you want to do recommendations?
Yeah, please. Recommendations.
Okay, so I actually went back and forth on the recommendations because at first I thought, like, what's the threat this episode? It's human sacrifice. So I was like, what's a good human sacrifice movie? And the best human sacrifice movie is The Wicker Man. It's just like, it's by far the best. Not the Nick Cage version. It's the Christopher Lee. Watch the Christopher, like, just, it's such a good movie. It needs to be watched. It's crazy. I realized, like, maybe this episode is more about trying to resurrect an already dead vampire, which is more of a Dracula movie trope than anything else. So now my recommendation is to watch the Hammer Horror sequels. Again, Christopher Lee, that was the connection. So Christopher Lee vampire Dracula sequels. Specifically, Dracula Prince of Darkness is the third Hammer Dracula movie, and it's the first time Dracula gets resurrected in them. And he is resurrected similar to in this episode where somebody is tied up, hanging upside down above his body and gets their throat slit for their blood.
Is Joan Collins in that movie?
She's not. Joan Collins is not in any of the Dracula movies. Of the Hammer Dracula movies. Sorry. So those are my recs for this episode.
Awesome. Does anybody else have any recommendations?
Nope.
No. Travis recommends The Italian Job again. That's weird, but okay.
It's got great prop work. There is good prop work in this episode, though. The scene in the dream sequence where Willow and Xander trade snacks is actually really nice. I really, really like that moment. Yeah, it's excellent prop work.
It's really good prop work. all right, I'll try to come up with recommendations for next week.
And maybe that says something about Xander and Willow's life, that like Willow probably can't eat junk because of her parents, so she throws the apple to Xander, and Xander throws her candy, right? And then Xander probably doesn't get enough nutrition at home. So he needs an apple to stay healthy.
Because his mom is always calling to the Chinese place. We know that.
Yeah.
His dad isn't around.
Another prediction. We'll never visit Xander's house.
Oh, right. Is that official?
Okay. I know there was a scene where Xander was listening to country music by himself in his bed. That is not a visit. That is a man by himself being lonely. Not go to Xander's house.
So he knows
Xander Hess.
We're never going to meet his parents. How about that? We'll never meet Xander's parents.
Oh, okay.
All right. I think that's it for this episode, guys. We have a Twitter account. I don't know any of that information.
If you like the podcast, follow us on Twitter. It's Buffy Virgin Pod. Our Instagram is just Buffy Virgin. Us and stuff.
Like us on Facebook and YouTube.
We're not on those things, Travis.
Someday we will be. And then someone's going to listen to this and be like, hey, that guy was thinking ahead.
But you can follow some of us individually on Facebook and YouTube and stuff, like Michael and me.
And Dennis, you can only find Dennis on Facebook. You should buy all of
his comics. Everything, man.
You can buy his comics on Amazon.com. And
Dennis has got a comic that's going to be, or a drawing that's going to be in the issue of She-Wolf that should be out by the time.
Yes, She-Wolf. Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, pick up issue 5 if you want to see a pinup of She-Wolf. And that's a general recommendation. If you like Buffy, you might like She-Wolf.
And then, visit DennisComics.com, see all Dennis's comics and cool illustrations. He's got some great Buffy ones that, you know, should be available somewhere. Probably BuffyVirgin.com or the Instagram, definitely.
Yeah. And leave us a comment if you like the new format, if you hate the new format, or if you, there's something special about an episode that you really liked, you know, let us know, like, this is what really got me going or so, or anything special that you want us to talk about. We'll also do that.
Yeah, we'll do anything.
Just like us.
Do you have any questions about our teenage trauma that we haven't addressed?
Oh, man.
Next episode is Some Assembly Required, right?
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
So stay tuned.